Are you the kind of person who saves the best to last? Or are you the kind of person who wants the best right now? You can't wait. Whether it's the best laptop or the best shoes, you've got to have it now. Are you that kind of person? Or the person who's prepared to wait for the best to come at the end? Now, I remember when I was a young guy, maybe I would have been about 5 or 6 years old, and every so often I'd go to my grandma's house, and sometimes we'd have dinner there. And I remember one day my uncle was there, and he told me that when you eat your dinner, it's best to save the best to last. In other words, you've got your meat and veggies. I was a bit deprived as a young child, didn't have some of the nice Asian food, right? It's just your standard meat and veggies. And as it is for lots of children, you tend not to like some of your veggies, right? Some vegetables are nice, but I used to not like peas. To me, peas are like little green balls of evil, right? Anyway, my uncle told me that the best way of eating your dinner is, you know, get the stuff you don't like, get that done with first, you know. So eat your peas first, mix it in with something else, your other veggies, and whatever you think is the best, you want to finish off your meal on a good taste, right? So you save the best till last. But saving the best till last means you have to wait. And I guess the question for each one of us is, are we prepared to wait? Now, this is an important question. I reckon most of us are impatient. We're not prepared to wait. Now, think about the Western world. There are big economic problems at the moment. Why is that? Well, the Western world is drowning in debt. Why is that? Well, it's because we want prosperity now without waiting for the accumulation of savings from hard work. One of the worst financial decisions a person can make is to borrow money to buy a car. Anyone here ever done that before? Unless having a car actually helps you to get an income, right? By having a car, you're able to go to work and stuff like that. Unless having a car helps you in that way, then borrowing money to buy a car is a bad investment. Basically, what you're doing is you're going into debt to purchase an asset that is going to depreciate or go down in value. But why do people do that? You know, I've got to borrow money to buy a car. Basically, it's because they want it now. They want the veneer of prosperity, the look of having their own car, before the accumulation of savings through hard work. And a similar thing applies to people. Why do they steal? Why do people cheat? Why do people embezzle? It's because they want the prosperity that comes with having money without having to work for it in a legitimate way. Now, the other day, I got a phone call. It's the second time in a week that this has happened to me, when someone with a foreign accent saying that they were from Microsoft Service Center, they're telling me that my computer had a virus problem. Anyone else ever received a phone call like that before? Now, I always love that phone call because I don't use Windows much these days. I actually use Linux operating systems. But when the guy asked me if I had a Windows computer, because it was the second time in a week, I told him, yeah, I've got 1,000 of them. And he promptly hung up on me. I think he got the idea. I was onto the scam. But why do people seek to scam others of their money? Why are there people around who do that? It's because they're not prepared to wait. They're not prepared to put in the hard work. They want money now without working for it legitimately. And in a similar way, this happens all across the board in various avenues in our society. For example, why do people, increasingly these days it seems, get involved in physical relationships without getting married first? You know, that was the thing to be done previously. Basically, a lot of these things happen because people want the benefits of love and friendship without the commitment. They're not prepared to seek love and physical intimacy in the proper way where one's lifelong commitment to the other person is acknowledged publicly first. And that's just a symptom of this I want it now kind of culture that we have. We want everything now, and we're not prepared to wait for something good to come at some time in the future. But God's plan for the world actually requires us to wait, because we'll see from today that God is into saving the best till last. Now, this is illustrated for us in the story of the wedding at Cana, when Jesus miraculously turned water into wine. Now, we're told in chapter 2, verse 1, that this event took place on the third day. Now, if we take the third day here as being 3 days after the previous episode, then this marks the seventh day. Now, given Jesus' habit of performing miracles on the Sabbath, we're probably meant to understand here that this day was not just, you know, 7 days after he had started working, preaching after his baptism, but it was literally a Saturday, the Jewish day of rest, the Sabbath day. Now, the fact that Jesus seems to have performed his first recorded miracle on a Sabbath day, this points to the underlying structure of God's plan for human history. Now, remember back when God created the world. How did he do it? Back in the beginning, God did so over 6 days, and then he rested on the seventh. Why did he do it that way? He could have done it all in the space of a second if he wanted to. Why take his time over 6 days? Well, God's activity of 6 days of work, followed by an eternal day of rest, is a deliberate picture of God's plan for the history of the world. He created the world in such a way that it's kind of model for what he's going to do in the rest of human history. The 6 days symbolize the time of human endeavor and work. But this time of human history will one day be complete and come to an end. And just like when you go off to work, you come home, and what do? You like to put your feet up for a while, right? You rest. After our time of work as the human race has come to the end, then God's promise is that we will enter an eternal Sabbath rest, just like God himself did back in the beginning. And this eternal Sabbath rest will be a time of liberation, a time of freedom, when God's blessing and the fruits of our labour will be fully enjoyed. Now, understanding this, it's totally appropriate that Jesus' first recorded miracle took place on the seventh day. Through this miracle, Jesus revealed God's glory so that people could experience joy and freedom as a result of God's provision of blessing. Now, the wedding that took place on the seventh day took place in a small village in Galilee. It was a place called Cana. Now, this was about 2 or 3 hours' walk north of Nazareth. And like with most weddings, there was a time of celebration, with guests being invited to attend. And we're told that Mary, Jesus' mother, was there, and also Jesus himself and some of Jesus' disciples. Now, the fact that Mary and Jesus were invited to the wedding, it suggests that Mary's family was acquainted with the family who were hosting the wedding. But there was a problem, wasn't there? Now, imagine you turned up to your wedding reception only to find out that the kitchen had burnt down. No food. That would be rather embarrassing, don't you think? Now, Jewish wedding feasts back then could last up to 7 days. So we're talking about a lot of food and drink. And running out of wine would have been a cause for severe social embarrassment. And also the fact that they ran out of wine on this occasion probably suggests that maybe the families involved weren't that well off. Either that, or some of their friends were very heavy drinkers. Anyway, Mary, she heard about this lack of wine. perhaps because she was seated with the other women down near the kitchen somewhere, or perhaps because she was involved in the organisation of the wedding. But this is where Mary came up with a bright idea. There's someone special here who might be able to do something about this problem. Or at least it seemed like a good idea to her. She went and told Jesus, "They don't have any wine." No doubt Mary thought that Jesus would be able to do something about it. But Jesus wasn't as eager about this as his mum. Jesus responded to his mum basically by saying, if we were to say or translate it literally, "Woman, what have I to do with you? My hour has not yet come." Now, back in those days, to call a lady by the term woman wasn't as disrespectful as it is for us in our English-speaking culture today. For them, addressing someone as woman was a respectful form of address, but it was an unusual form of address to direct towards one's mother. So Jesus does seem to be establishing here some measure of distance between himself and his mother. And the expression, "What have I to do with you?" Well, this is, normally when it occurs in the Bible, fairly harsh in tone. It's usually used to deny that there's something in common between the speaker and the person being spoken to. Basically, it seems like Jesus is suggesting to his mum that his power could not be called on for everyday purposes. In saying "my hour" or "my time has not yet come," Jesus was respectfully but strongly telling his mother that she shouldn't assume that he could perform miracles whenever she wanted him to. Now, this idea of Jesus' hour or Jesus' time is something that we see a number of times occurring in John's Gospel. In John's Gospel, Jesus' hour or time is basically the time when Jesus is going to reveal his glory through his death and resurrection. Now, every time Jesus performs a miracle, something of his power and glory is revealed, right? But what is Jesus' greatest miracle? Well, that's going to happen through his death and resurrection. And that is when his time will have come. Even though Jesus performed many miracles during his public ministry, it was necessary for him to suffer and to die, and after that to be resurrected, and that would be his greatest miracle. Even Mary, Jesus is saying here, even Mary had to wait. To expect too much before the appropriate time was just not the right thing. Now think about it. Jesus has the ability to do whatever he wants, basically, right? He can perform miracles. He's God in human form, so he has the power of God available to him. Well, if he wanted to, Jesus could have performed 1,000 miracles on the very first day of his ministry. He could have said to Mary on that occasion, "Hey, Mum, not just the wine, but how about a liter of ice cream for everyone who lives in the region of Galilee?" He could have said that, and he could have done it. I guess he would have introduced ice cream for the very first time in human history, perhaps, right? He could have made a fortune out of it if he had packaged it and sold it. Now, Jesus could have done it that way if he wanted to, but the outworking of God's power will take place in stages, according to God's plan and according to God's timetable. And Jesus was helping his mum to try and see something of that fact. Now, one of the problems I have with extreme Pentecostals, you know, those Christians who are always looking for miracles behind every sort of cupboard door, the problem is, if you're always looking for miracles, it might suggest that you're a little bit impatient. Now, it's good to want the fullness of heaven now. It's good to want to have a perfect world right here and now, to be healed of all of our diseases. But it's not our place to say when and how God should perform a miracle. God has his own timetable. And sometimes he wants us to wait. And waiting requires faith. Anyway, despite the fact that Jesus' hour had not yet come, Mary was still confident that Jesus would act to help out in some way or other. And her instruction to the servants, to do whatever he tells you to do, this hints at the appropriate attitude that everyone should have to Jesus, to obey what he tells us to do. But what was Jesus going to do? Well, so happened that there were 6 stone jars there on that occasion. They were stone jars that were used for Jewish ceremonial washing. Now, stone jars were used by the Jews for this purpose because they were considered to protect the water from ceremonial defilement more than jars made of other substances. And each jar could hold about 100 litres, which means that when you add them together, they would have had enough water to fill a Jewish ceremonial immersion pool. You know, a little bit like how people get baptised, right? Put all the water in there and you can have a ceremonial washing. Now, the fact that these were Jewish ceremonial water jars and that they were at the time empty is significant. But we'll talk about that later on. For now, we see that Jesus told the servants to go and to fill the jars up with water. And we're told that the servants filled them up to the top. Here we see that the servants followed Mary's instruction and they obeyed Jesus' words. The detail describing how they filled the jars up to the very brim shows their eagerness in obeying Jesus. Now, according to Jewish law, Jesus' use of the ceremonial jars for common purposes would have rendered them unclean. But here we see Jesus placing love for the family above ritual concerns. You know, the family who was organising the wedding on that occasion, Jesus actually thought about their situation. But even more than that, there is greater significance here. And that is the significance of what Jesus was doing and the significance of this miracle. Part of the purpose of this miracle and why it's recorded here in John's Gospel is to help us to see that Jesus is literally the fulfillment of Judaism and everything that the Old Testament looked forward to. Note how the jars were originally empty. This symbolises the dryness and barrenness of the Old Testament age, the time of the Old Covenant. Back in the Old Testament, that was a time when the work of God's Holy Spirit was limited. But Jesus has come, in accordance with Old Testament prophecy, to pour out the Spirit in a full sense, so that life and joy might be experienced in abundance. In other words, the old covenant age of emptiness and thirst, well, this miracle is pointing to the fact that it's Jesus who changes that situation. It's Jesus who changes that old covenant age problem of emptiness and thirst into the new covenant age of abundance. Jesus has come to change curse into blessing. As Isaiah 44 verse 3 says, I will pour out water on the thirsty lands and streams on the dry ground. I will pour out my Spirit upon your offspring and my blessing will be poured out on your descendants. That's a prophecy there in the Old Testament. And Jesus is hooking into that through the miracle here. He's helping us to see that he is the fulfillment of that prophecy. In addition, Jesus' making of wine, it's also a sign that he has come in fulfillment of other Old Testament prophecies that describe the new covenant age in terms of an abundance of new wine. And one of the examples here is the passage which was read out for us at the start of our service today From Isaiah 25, verse 6, it says, "On this mountain, which is Jerusalem, the Lord Almighty will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever, and the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away or remove from all the earth." You see here what God is saying. He is telling us that human history involves a movement from the old to the new, a movement from curse to blessing, a movement from sadness to joy, from death to life. That's how God has planned things. And as part of this, God is saving the best till last. And this idea about God saving the best till last, it's quite obvious, isn't it, from the way in which this story in the Bible here finishes. After transforming the water into wine, Jesus instructed the servants to draw some of the liquid content of the jars and to take it to the master of the banquet. Now, the master of the banquet, or the master of the feast, was a position of honour and responsibility. It was an MC, right? But an MC is not just a figurehead up there conducting things from the stage, but an MC with real power and responsibility, whose job was to work out what actually happened in the feast and to make sure that there was food and drink available for all of the guests. Now, the master of the feast, according to Jewish custom, he was also, among other things, to regulate the consumption of the wine so that people would avoid falling into the sin of drunkenness. And once again here we see that the servants followed Jesus' instruction to the letter. They took some of the liquid from the jars to the MC. But it wasn't just any ordinary liquid, right? This was top-notch stuff. Have a look at what happened in verses 9 and 10. When the master of the banquet tasted the water which had become wine, and he didn't know where it had come from, the master of the banquet called the bridegroom, whose family would have been in charge of providing the food and wine for the feast, and said to him, "Everyone sets the good wine first, and when they get drunk, they bring out the inferior wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." See what's happening here? The best wine had been kept till the end. Now here we also need to know that one of the other functions of the master of the banquet in that time was to test the quality of the wine before it was distributed to the guests. You couldn't have the guests drinking any old plonk, right? It had to be at least consumable. But this time the wine was of such good quality that the master of the banquet called the bridegroom over from his interaction with the guests to praise him for the quality of the wine. Now, even though drunkenness was disapproved of in Jewish culture, and we assume that drunkenness probably wouldn't have been an issue on this particular occasion, but it is still true, and it was still standard practice amongst the Jews of the day, to serve the better wine first. You want to make a good impression from the beginning, right? Now, even if the guests didn't become drunk, their sense of taste would still be dulled over time, particularly if they're at the feast for more than one day. Now, Jewish wine wasn't fermented deliberately, but it did develop alcohol content due to natural fermentation. And it was also usual for the wine to be watered down by 2 or 3 parts water to 1 part wine. But here we see the quality of this wine was what stood out to the MC. The best wine had been kept till last. Now, the MC didn't know it, but his statement there actually captures something of God's way of working in history. And that's exactly why it's recorded here for us. God saves the best till last. You know, when you think about it, God could have organized this world in any way whatsoever he wanted. He could have arranged for sin never ever to be a problem, for sin never ever to have entered our world. But he didn't. He could have sent Jesus early on. He could have unleashed the power, the full power of his Spirit from, you know, right early on, just after Adam and Eve had sinned. But he didn't. The fact that God took 6 long days to create and order the world before it was complete and very good is a picture of what God is doing in the world and what his plan is. He's going to take his time. Well, why would God take his time? Why not get it all over and done with in a split second? He could have done it that way. Why is he taking his time? It's because God is the ultimate storyteller. Human history is his story. And just like with any story, it takes time to tell it. You can't appreciate the ending of a story without knowing the preceding narrative. And that's the way that God has chosen to structure things. Now, this saving of the best till last, it's connected with Jesus' miraculous power and the revelation of his glory. Verse 11 tells us that the miracle of turning water into wine was the beginning of his signs. This miracle was a sign because it signified how Jesus has come to complete God's plan of salvation, to change emptiness into fullness, to change sadness into joy, to change death into life. But the key to the coming of the new, the key to the coming of life and joy and blessing into the world was found in Jesus himself. He's the one who brings about this transformation. And the purpose of this miracle is to tell us that, to help us to see that Jesus is the one who brings in what is best. That the fullness of blessing can only come through Jesus. But the question for each one of us is, okay, well, that's the sign, that's the miracle, I can understand what it's talking about here. The question is for each one of us, though, will we accept this? Now, when Jesus showed this sign, when he revealed his glory, we're told in verse 11 that his disciples believed in him. They understood something of the significance of the sign and they accepted the truth that the sign revealed about Jesus. The question for each one of us, however, is, do we accept it? Do we accept that what I'm talking about here is actually the truth? Do we accept the idea that Jesus has come to bring in the best? Do we believe that? Well, why then aren't you prepared to wait? If Jesus truly is the bringer of the best, if Jesus truly is the bringer of blessing, if the fullness of life and joy is found only through Jesus, then why is it that we're so easily tempted to look for security and satisfaction in other places? If we truly believe that Jesus is the answer, then why are we spending so much of our time trying to work out our own solution to our problems and just making things worse? If we truly believe that Jesus is the one, then what that means for each one of us is that we will start to realise that our own attempts to save ourselves or to help ourselves is just making things worse. And that what we need to do is to give up our futile attempts at trying to satisfy our own desires and to start to trust in Jesus to bring us what we need, when we need it. If you truly believe that God has saved the best till last and that this comes about through Jesus, then you'll be prepared to wait for God's good provision. Now, I acknowledge that at times it can be difficult to wait. You know, who doesn't want the best right now? You know, the best job, the best car, the best house, the best clothes, the best smartphone, the best education, you name it. Deep down, we all want the best. But what is best for you is what God wants for you. Even if that requires something bad to happen to you first, in order for you in the end to get to be able to appreciate the good that God is doing for you. So friends, if Jesus is the one who brings in the best, and if we believe that fact, we need to be prepared to wait and to keep on trusting that in Jesus we have what is best. In fact, what can never, ever be surpassed. The truth of the matter is, God saves the best till last. What does that mean for you?